Yes, Smith versus State, Sharon Dickinson on behalf of the appellant, and Hagar Kapidi on behalf of
Hagar Kapidi.
Kapidi on behalf of the respondent. Justice Seda, can you hear adequately?
I can. Thank you very much.
Hi. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Whitney Wilson. In this case, Whitney was placed under Legal 2000 by Metro police officers and transported to Centennial Hills Hospital for a 72-hour mental health commitment. Now, she understood what was going on. She was cooperative. She was not in restraints when she arrived at the hospital, and she voluntarily changed her clothes into a hospital uniform. She gave up her personal possessions. But about 45 minutes after she was in the hospital, something unusual occurred. Whitney testified that while she was laying on a gurney in the hospital uniform, someone attempted to spread her legs and place something inside her vagina or touch her genitals. Now, this occurred when she was in emergency room 34 under the care of Nurse Ray Suma. At trial, she testified she was only protecting herself when she tried to stop this attempt sexual assault or unlawful touching. She never consented to any medical procedure that would allow for this type of touching to occur. She said she began swinging her arms. She was agitated. She did not remember ever kicking Nurse Rachel Thomason during this incident. I bring these facts to the court's attention because we're asking the court to dismiss, reverse and dismiss this case based on the insufficiency of the evidence. I want to point out that no one from Centennial Hills testified as to what happened in 34 at the time of the trial. All the witnesses who testified as to what occurred after they arrived at the river based on the commotion that was going on. We believe that there are several errors that occurred in this case, which allowed the jury to go ahead and find her guilty and convict her of battery on a health care provider. And three of the areas that he's going to discuss were the jury instructions, the other bad acts, and the prosecutorial misconduct in the closing. With regard to the jury instructions, at the time of the trial, the defense submitted numerous instructions, and the self-defense instruction was patterned after Runyon with two changes. Rather than there being a fear of being injured, they asked there be a fear of unlawful touching, because this is what occurred in this case based on Whitney's testimony. She believed that she was being unlawfully touched, or somebody was attempting to sexually assault her. If you look at jury instruction 12, you'll see that the court did not agree with what the defense proposed. The defense proposed instruction is at page 27. The defense asked that all the situations where it says in the sentence danger be changed to unlawful touching or fear that she will be touched unlawfully. They also asked for other changes. In the first sentence, they wanted this to be, rather than justify self-defense, they wanted to say, justify the lawful use of force. The court disagreed. The court instead called the Runyon case. And this is incorrect, because Runyon is a murder case, and this is a battery case. NRS 193.240 justifies these changes in the jury instruction, because this statute allows you to use sufficient resistance to prevent an offense which may be made by the party to be about to be injured to prevent an offense against his or her person. So clearly, under NRS 193.240, this should have been a change to be an unlawful touching.
Why would it? There's a departure between unlawful touching in your proposed instruction and the offensive touching that is referenced in the Myers case. Is there a reason for that discrepancy, and is that significant?
I think they're similar, unlawful touching and offensive touching. In fact, I think offensive touching would be a broader term. It would incorporate any type of lewd touching. Unlawful would actually make the jury, have the jury decide whether the act was lawful or not. So I think they're very similar.
But in the context of this specific crime, which is, would be analogous to resisting arrest with a battery on a police officer context, does the statute that creates the specific offense abrogate the general common law or 193.240 right of self-defense? In other words, in creating a specific type of offense, battery on a healthcare worker, or battery on a police officer who's effectuating an arrest, do those statutes somehow abrogate the general right of self-defense that obtains because of the personnel doing the touching?
No, I don't think they do. They may allow a person to use more force than somebody walking on the street if they're acting lawfully, because in each case they have to be acting lawfully. So I do believe still have the right self-defense if the police officer or healthcare provider if they're doing something unlawful. Also missing from this jury instruction is a sentence right out of Runyon, which says the use of force is lawful even if it develops afterward that the person serving self-defense was mistaken to the extent of the danger. And that's right out of Runyon, and the district court refused to make that instruction. We offered a lot of other instructions with regards to...
Before you move on, I see that we might have different instructions, but I see how this one for the rule. The language of the statute focuses on injury. It does not address the proposed substituted language of unlawful touching. Where in the statute do you get that addition?
Well, I find that from NRS 193.240. This isn't a murder case, this is a single battery case.
So where in the statute do you find the source for
unlawful touching in that statute? It says resistance sufficient to prevent the offense may be able to support you out to the injured. So I understand it to mean that you can use force if somebody is threatened to assault you. And I think unlawful touching, which we talked about in the Mayor case and the California Hebrew Hospital case, an unlawful touching can happen in a hospital because hospital employees and doctors can be convicted of assault or unlawful touching.
But you're asking us to add to the self-defense instruction the words unlawful touching. Of the statute itself.
Well, I'm asking the court to consider Runyon, which says to tailor the facts of the case to the instruction. And in this case, the facts were unlawful touching, which he has the right to defend himself against. Otherwise, if you're in the hospital, you know, the hospital staff will treat you whatever they want. So there has to be some protection there, especially if it's somebody who's committed under a mental health issue. There has to be some protection there for the person who's in the hospital.
That takes you back to Justice Pickering's question, where the statute that describes the elements of the crime, battery of a health care, and couple that with the instruction privilege of healthcare providers to undertake certain activities. Is that appropriate? Is it to grant a self-defense instruction?
Yes, we objected to the other instruction. We did not think it should have been given with regard to the three elements that the court had, the jury looked at, to the reasonableness of the healthcare providers in this case. But my understanding is that under the statute, if a police officer uses excess force and is not acting lawfully, you know,
you do have the right to defend yourself. Because one of the elements is that the officer is acting lawfully and having his documents. So I do believe there is self-defense. Can the judge here believe that there was self-defense available in this case? And that's why he gave the jury instruction that we can have this to correct.
Well, if you could address the prejudice problem, this question problem. The instruction that was given, you say, was an error of the law. And I'm trying to understand how was your client prejudiced in not making the exact same argument under the theory of defense for the instruction versus the law standard?
No, I think we have to look at all the instructions together. The ones that were rejected that talk about the reasonableness of the hospital staff between her restraints, consent, and all the other instructions that were rejected under chapter 3, school Q3, and chapter 41A. And that, and this instruction that requires a potential injury, either you can be touched offensively, not be injured. So this raises the burden for us in self-defense. In fact, we believe that a more touching is sufficient, especially when you look at all the other statutes that address how hospital staff is supposed to handle community orders. And the jury board is not given these instructions.
So you're saying that by using the word injury, the client was deprived of the self-defense instruction because the nature of touching the client clear.
Well, I think that the sexual assault could be an attempt to injury. A touching of the genital.
But the trial counsel argued with respect to self-defense, even though you didn't have the instruction you wanted, the opposing argument that this counsel's argument with respect to self-defense on this instruction.
I believe he still offered that. He argued that the hospital staff acted improperly, and that she had a right to defend herself because she believed that she was being touched unlawfully. But when you look, we can't, if you look at all the other instructions that we might get in that pose, the chemical restraints, all the other ones, we're at a disadvantage in the argument because the court gave a lengthy instruction justifying the hospital's actions. And he also gave an instruction that said a nurse is a health care. It's improper under Pende and others. I want to point out also.
But to carry on Justice Hart's point for a moment, the instruction that's given that she could resist an injury with force, the running instruction using the term injury. And if I understood you correctly, counsel was able to argue she feared an injury in that she feared imminent sexual assault. And therefore, that instruction should apply. That argument was made, correct?
As I recall, it was made. I believe that they focused more on the touching, because that's what her testimony was. Her testimony was always unlawful touching. But the jury instruction did not say that,
right?
Okay, so that was the problem that we had in order to close them. I just want to touch briefly on the other bad acts in the prosecutorial misconduct, because the state used the other bad acts with regard to the incident that happened before she got to the hospital. They say it was admissible under res justa, because justa is a very narrow statute in. And under the cases cited, I think if you look at the cases, the Nevada cases cited, you can see that they did not fit through this narrow rule. And even though they were saying it was to be used for the complete story of the crime, in closing, they argued it was to be used to show her intent. And I think I have less than a minute left to reserve that. Yes.
Good May it please the court, my name is Tamar Shafidi, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada, Ms. Keeler. And appellate has raised several issues, and we're focused primarily on the self-defense instructions, which she touched upon. And in regards to instruction number 12, appellant makes claims that the district court improperly failed to instruct regarding the unlawful punching language. It's the state's position that had the district court instructed regarding unlawful punching, that would actually have lowered the standard of self-defense to a lower standard than the Runyon versus State case provided for. Runyon sufficiently gave sample jury instructions, which included apparent danger language and actual danger language. And by using unlawful punching language, it would lower the standard of self-defense in Nevada because it would assume that everybody would be trained that they were unlawfully touched and thus be entitled to self-defense based on that purpose. And that is not the law in Nevada. We have to take a look at whether it was reasonable for the person to assume that they were subject to harm. And only in that case would we then be able to use self-defense. We're also, it is also the state's position that the that appellant's use of, or that appellant's that the district court felt that the unlawful appellant also claims that the district court should have included language that use of force is lawful even if it develops afterwards that person was mistaken as to a sense of danger. It is the state's position that, number one, appellant failed to preserve this argument because appellant failed to make this objection at trial. And number two, this language was covered in instruction number 12, which states that a person is justified if they are confronted by the appearance of danger and not just actual danger. So that's covered there. Appellant also, in their brief, makes the argument that the district court failed to include a duty to retreat instruction. And it's the state's position. And what I mean by duty to retreat instruction is that there should have been an instruction.
Sorry, before you move on to the duty to retreat instruction, I'd like to ask you a question about the self-defense instruction. The state's argument is that the tender instruction by the defense was inconsistent with the statutory language.
I'm sorry.
Is it the state's position that the tender instruction by the defense was inconsistent with the 93-24?
Yes.
Under Lenin, as counsel argues, this court instructed and is to tailor the instruction to the circumstances of the case. Wouldn't that permit the district court, in a case such as this, on murder, to tailor the self-defense instruction in a manner that is consistent with the facts of the case? In this case, the unlawful touching.
I agree completely. However, despite the fact that Runyon is a murder case, the gist of the self-defense language is applicable to this case. And we feel that Runyon absolutely applies to this case because it goes to whether there was an actual and apparent danger to the person.
Was it the state's argument in closing that this instruction received to rest on self-defense because Ms. Wiseman's belief that she was facing danger was not reasonable? That one of the facts that supported her claim when she was facing it.
I would say both. Her, we argued during closing arguments that her belief that she was being harmed was unreasonable, and that the facts just didn't add up to a reasonable belief in self-defense. That her actual belief was unreasonable, and that's because when you take a look at the actual facts of this case, the events leading up to the circumstances, the reason she was placed on a legal hold in the first place, the fact that she actually, you know, she's argued in front of the jury that she didn't recall what exactly happened in the room, yet the testimony from Nurse Thompson, the victim in this case, was completely contradictory to that. She testified that.
He argues to us that the record is devoid of any facts as to what transpired in the room or what the nurse had in the room.
And we submit that that's incorrect because the nurse. Nurse Thompson actually testified during this trial. She testified that the defendant, Wissman, looked her directly in the eye before delivering the kick to her face. And she...
Counsel, that doesn't address what I believe the defendant, in this case the appellant, is expressing was what she was reacting to. I believe that it came as a result of two male individuals being in the room before the nurse was present. Or am I not correct on that?
Her argument is that she delivered the kick because she thought she was being sexually assaulted when the nurses were placing the catheter inside her.
And so under the facts of this case, the suggestion that's made by the appellant that under the state's reasoning, there would never be an opportunity for someone who finds himself in a precarious, shall we say, situation in a hospital could in fact defend themselves until the actual harm or the apparent harm is upon them. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it's our statement that that it's not reasonable for her to believe that she was being harmed because there was testimony that the practice of the nurse that actually placed the catheter inside her, that it was his routine practice to inform every patient before he was completing any type of procedure, he would inform the patient exactly what he was about to be doing and what was about to take place. He would inform them of the procedure, and for that reason, it's not reasonable for her to believe that she was about to be harmed.
So your argument, Mr. Reed, is that the time that the nurse was kicked by there were no facts to support contention that Ms. Travis was in fear or in danger of that matter of unlawful touching.
Exactly.
So therefore, in response to the state's burden to prove self-defense was in the defense, there were no facts to show that she was in danger or in fear of unlawful touching, even if the defense instruction had been given.
Exactly. Another instruction.
One final question on the self-defense instruction. Is the case Eagle versus Myers out of California? Are you familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with the facts of that. If you provide the facts, I can count
you. No, if you're not familiar with the case, I'm not going to answer this problem.
Another instruction that is argued is. As I mentioned previously, the duty to retreat instruction. And what happened in that hospital room demonstrates also that retreat was actually not factually possible.
She was pinned down. Who was she going to retreat to?
Exactly. Another instruction that was brought up in the brief was whether the district court incorrectly had the instruction that a nurse is a healthcare worker. And appellant makes the argument that this instruction shouldn't have been given because it used an element of the crime as an instruction, which is they contend is inappropriate. It's the state's position, however, that the elements of this case weren't whether a nurse is actually a healthcare worker.
But the problem that they're arguing is two instructions combined
caused the offending problem. I think they accept your point, maybe. A nurse is a healthcare product. But you also had an instruction that said Rachel Thomason is a nurse. So their point is those two instructions combined, in effect, said Rachel Thomason is a healthcare provider for purposes of this crime battery on a healthcare provider. That's their point, I think. Could you comment on that?
Well, it was actually our position that the elements of the case are whether Nurse Thompson was a healthcare provider, whether she was actually acting in the scope of her duties as a healthcare provider, and more importantly, whether the defendant knew or should have known that she was acting as a healthcare worker. Those were the actual elements of the crime, and we feel that the district court properly gave both those instructions. In regard to the res gestae evidence being admitted by the district court, it is the state's position that the evidence provided a full and accurate account of the events that led up to the reason that the defendant was in the hospital room in the first place. And Bracken versus State, 1988 case where this court actually held that the state is entitled to present a full and accurate account of circumstances surrounding the commission of crime. It would be simply too confusing for the jury to hear evidence regarding the legal 2000 hold without understanding fully and accurately the events that led up to the reason she was in the hospital in the first place. The district court also properly instructed the jury in regards to that evidence that they should not consider it for any other purpose that would be prejudicial in nature. And furthermore, it's the state's position that the defendant opened the door to hearing such evidence because she made it an issue during the trial by stating that the health care workers exceeded the amount of force necessary. So she opened the door, the state in response, decided to inform the jury of what exactly transpired. And I'd also like to point out that the events that occurred previously were not bad acts. Courts have repeatedly held that suicidal intentions are not considered crimes. So the fight that she had with her mother before she wound up at the hospital, the reason that the nurses placed her on a legal 2000 hold was absolutely relevant in presenting a full and accurate account to the jury. And that concludes my argument today. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you.
Can you please get Ms. Gibbons in a few minutes? Thank you. I wanted to correct what I said about the closing argument. I just looked at it, and I did not see in every argument sexual assault or the injury or the unlawful touching. What I see in the argument is what she testified to, that somebody trying to spread her legs. So he did not specifically use those words. His closing argument, he argued that they did not bring in brothers in the room before Ms. Thompson came in. She only came in now.
So assuming that that correction of the record was noted, your argument would be that the attempted spreading of her legs was not an injury or an imminent danger. Self-defense, whereas the modification of self-defense instruction for unlawful touching would allow your client to make that point.
Correct. It would have been an easier way to argue it because she testified to spreading her legs, and then she testified that she fought him. And then there was a dispute about what was the return of the captain, and it was the return of sexual assault. Sure. Nobody quite knew because they did not bring in anybody who was in the room when she was there.
The only thing I want to point out is we did.
What about the point that the counsel makes for the state that the testimony at the time of the kicking from the Bears was that there was no attempt to spread your client's legs or insert a catheter or do anything else that provided grounds for unlawful touching? She was not reasonably in the fear and the danger of doing unlawful touching.
Well, the nurse came in after the fact, and when she came in, the security guards already had her on the back of the gurney and were trying to pin her down. Ms. Wisner testified that she was scared, but pinning her down, she didn't know what was going on based on the unlawful touching, and she testified she had happened right before this. The nurse did not. Are they the security? So I guess that at that time.
Because the nurse's entrance in the room was close at the time, which reason her fear that the nurse would participate in the unlawful touching.
I think so, but she did not even remember the nurse being there. She remembered them all trying to tie her down. The people had been under restraints at that time. She testified she did not remember kicking her, she did not remember kicking her. So I think it was more of defending herself against people or equipment or any kind of restraints.
Thank you. Justice Sada, do you have anything to add?
I do not. Thank you.
Justice Harrison. Thank you very much.